bridge or introduction to something else that people have been interested in, the new economics or Keynesian economics or John Maynard Keynes. And so on Wednesday, I'm going to talk about him. Now, the way I want to proceed is I want to urge you to interrupt at any time because you're puzzled about something, or you don't know what I'm talking about, or you wonder why I'm talking about whatever it is I'm talking about. I don't have a whole body of truths that I've got to get across this morning. I want to answer your questions. Now, maybe, though, you don't know what your questions are as we begin. Now, at the bottom, it's what all these columns are about. I've got the years down there from 1952 to 1968. These data are derived from official sources. Most of them come from the Department of Commerce, which has a huge statistics gathering and reassembling division. Some of them come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is a branch of the Department of Labor, and some of them come from the Federal Reserve System. But the first column on the left is the Consumer Price Index. That's the thing that every month, beginning of the month, you read a little item on the front page of your paper. The price level jumped another 1.2 points. That's gathered by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's very reliable. It's based on first-rate sampling methods. And I started in 1952 because that was the end of the Korean War. If you take a look at that CPI, Consumer Price Index, you see how the price level has moved since the end of the Korean War up through the end of last year. 1957 to 1959 equals 100. That was the base. Now, that's just an index, you know. What do you see in that? One of the things that I think you should notice is that until 1965, with the single exception of 1957, we have had creeping inflation, very slowly creeping inflation, right? Up about 1 to 1.5% per year. But in 1965, it really took off. And the price level now has been increasing at the rate of 4 or 5% per year. And that's an awful lot of price increase. If you've got a $10,000 insurance policy, for example, that will endow at age 85, and you are now 35, don't count on getting much out of that if the price level continues to increase at 5% per year. A lot of people, even before 1965, and we're very, very concerned about inflation. When you compare what's happened since 65 with what was happening in the previous 12 years or so, you really seem to have had little reason to be concerned. Now's the time to be concerned. I want to suggest to you that maybe the concern that we had with inflation before 1965 was even more misdirected than that first column indicates. But in order to get into that, or call your attention to some of these other things. This whole period of creeping inflation, 1952 down here through 1964, what caused it? Why were prices always going up? What do you think, basically? Who or what was fundamentally the cause of it?
Unions.
Unions, right. Thank you. That's what everybody said. I think that's completely wrong. I don't like unions, by the way. Hostility to any kind of trade group that tries to organize a market and keep other people out. So I'm very hostile to unions in every sense, including the American Association of University Professors, which I do not belong because I don't like unions. And the strongest union in the country is probably the American Medical Association. But there are all kinds of reasons why I doubt that this is true, and I'm not going to prove it, but let me call another explanation. If you're on the other side of the fence, you say it's due to monopolies. If you're in a labor union, you say it's monopolies. Well, the interesting thing is that unions are strongest in the areas where monopolies are strongest. I mean, industrial monopolies. Thus, you take, what are some of the monopolistic industries in this country? Steel, automobiles. Go down a list like this. Those happen also to be the industries in which the unions are strong. Well, now, doesn't prove anything, and I'm not trying to prove anything this morning, to give you a perspective of unions are much stronger in durable commodities industries than they are in non-durable commodities or services. So I just pulled out of the Consumer Price Index the index for durable commodities. Since this is where the industrial monopolies and the unions are strongest, if they're responsible for the inflation, that's where prices should have been rising the fastest. But behold, that's not where they've been rising the fastest. In fact, it tended until 1965 to hold remarkably steady. You can even pick on, in fact, the biggest bunch of monopolists are the automobile manufacturers. Look what's happened to the price of new cars in the 60s. It's gone down. Everything else has been going up. But these big oligopolists, that's a fancy word for few monopolists, they've actually been lowering the price. You say, well, you're right. Chevrolet's cost more today than it cost in 1960. Well, the price index takes account of improvements in quality. If you take account of all of the changes that have become standard equipment on the automobile, and there are very sound ways for doing this with automobiles, you find that the price you get more car per buck now than you were getting back in 1960. This shows our impressions are frequently quite wrong. Well, what has been pushing the consumer price index up? The real villain is the service industries. And not the unionized service industries either. This is the index for services. Now, services, the economists divide everything that's produced into three broad categories. Durable commodities, furniture, automobiles, non-durable commodities, clothing, food, and then services, medical care, haircuts, which I'm a little. The services have been the things whose price has really been increasing. And this is one important part of the explanation for the creeping price inflation. You see, as we have gotten wealthier, we've tended to accumulate all the non-durable commodities that we can swallow. You can always buy more clothes as you're wealthier, but after you've clothed, you have a few changes, the marginal utility of clothing declines for you. You're not keen on clothing anymore after you've got your wardrobe full. And similarly with food, which is the other big component of non-durable commodities. After you've got enough, you get some more money, you don't go out and spend it on food. So we shift then into durable commodities, but there's a point there too where we get kind of satiated. After you've got one car, your desire for a second car is considerably lower than your desire for a car was before you had any. And that second TV set isn't as urgent a necessity as the first one, and so on. So as we get wealthier, our desire for durable commodities tends relatively to slacken off too, which means that our increased income tends to be focused heavily in the area of demand for services. Now, the peculiarity of most of the service industries is that they do not lend themselves to automatic production techniques, or assembly line techniques, or cybernation, or whatever you want to call it. Take the barber, for example. The barber is cutting hair by the same technology today that he was using 30 years ago. Well, that just means that the price of the haircut is going to have to go up. In other words, the barber can cut as many heads of hair in an hour as he could do 30 years ago. But he expects to get, and must get in fact, if he's to remain in the barber business, otherwise he'll go out, an income that is equal to that which other people are getting who are producing automobiles. So, if we are not, in fact, willing to pay a higher price for haircuts, barbers will disappear. Now, to some extent, barbers have disappeared, but that's helped to keep the price of haircuts up. But in general, as we expand our demand for services, and the supply cannot be expanded as rapidly because this doesn't lend itself to improvements in output, like most service industries don't, the price rises relatively, and there you see it. And that's such a big component of consumer price index that it tends to push the whole thing up. So there is no villain. If there is a villain, it's us. Because we want more services. We want to be waited on more. We've got all kinds of things. Now we want people to fawn upon us. And the one component, and I said I didn't like the American Medical Association, they're not exclusive. Is there a doctor? practically the last 16 years, and shows no sign of abating. Because there are many reasons for that. One of them is that we want a lot more medical attention. You know, it used to be when you had the sniffles, you just complained. Now you've gone to the doctor. People are living longer. We expect a better quality of care. The Medicare program is responsible for it, too. I happen to be very skeptical about the desirability of the Medicare program. Not because I'm opposed to the government's providing medical services to needy citizens, but because I'm opposed to increasing the demand without increasing the supply. And we've got to do something about increasing the supply of medical services. The demand for medical services is, in economic jargon, extremely elastic. If you bring down the price of it to people, they will take a whole lot more. And if you just don't have a whole lot more available, you're not going to be able to make it available to them. So we've got to do something, and there are many things we could do. So the medical profession, like the teaching profession, is extremely conservative. But otherwise, there are many things we could do to improve the situation. Well, let me say again, interrupt at any time. I don't see your hand yell out. Before leaving this chart, I want you to look at another thing. Over here is the wholesale price index. There are good reasons for believing, I won't go into all of them, but there are good reasons for believing that the wholesale price index is a better indicator of whether we're having inflation or not than the consumer price index. Let me give you just one reason. I said that index on new cars reflected changes in quality, but there are many changes in quality that the index cannot pick up. And I think it's safe to say that quality is generally improving in the production of commodities and services in this country. Well, if the index can't pick up that improvement in quality, then it may indicate that a price increase has occurred when in fact no price increase has occurred. You're just getting better service for more money, which means not necessarily an increase. As an example, to take hospital care, which suggests that this may overstate the increase in the price of medical care services. Suppose the hospital gives you exactly the same service today that it gave you 10 years ago, but you pay half to get as much for it. But there's one difference. The doctor knows more about the disease and can prescribe a better medicine, so that 10 years ago you would have had to stay in the hospital 8 days. Now you get out in 4. Has the price gone up or down? Really, if you think of the thing that you want as health, the price of health has gone down. And there are many similar instances. If automobile tires are so improved that you now get 40,000 miles where you used to get 20,000 on average, and the price has increased 50%, then really the price of automobile tires has gone down. Now the consumer price index isn't capable of taking account of all of these improvements in quality for complicated reasons I won't go into. And that is one of the factors that leads some economists to prefer the wholesale price index as an indication of what's really happening to the basic price level in this country. And now I want you to notice that once again, until 1965, when we really took off in a period of inflation. And with the exception of the period from 1956 to about 58, early 58, we have had remarkable price stability in this country. In fact, the period from 1958 to 1964 is the longest period of price stability we've ever had. That's fascinating to think about, because through this period everyone was complaining about inflation. People have never seen charts, I don't have it up here, but the Federal Reserve puts out a graph showing the behavior of the wholesale price index since 1800. And people say, oh, the good old days when we were on the gold standard and prices were steady. They've never seen a record of prices. Prices used to just go like this throughout our history. They've always been moving up, causing people to feel irritated and rebellious, or down, causing irritated or rebellious. You know, the whole populist movement in the late 19th century can be interpreted as a response to falling prices. They really fell. And then they zoomed back up in the time of World War I. And then they zoomed back down after World War I. What has happened after World War II is different, is that they rose and there they stayed. But from 19, well, in general, our record from about 1952 to the present, even taking account of the inflation the last 2 years, has been better than over any comparable 15-year period. And that period of 1958 to 1964 is really remarkable. There's absolutely nothing approaching a precedent in our history. So people used to ask me, what are we going to do about inflation? And I say, I don't know, but whatever we're doing the right thing. We are having it. And it's extremely dangerous, you know, to get worried about a problem that doesn't exist, because then you may go out and solve it. All right. Now, well, I'm going to focus on this. Now, everybody says, I say, you say, and we all know, every housewife knows, we've been having inflation since 1964. How come? What causes inflation? Is it labor unions again? I was just reading a report by Tilford Gaines, who's an economist for a big bank in New York. And these guys, they've always got a blame on the unions. He knows better. His language is weaselly, but he does manage to stick in there about rising wage costs and excessive productivity gains. But he's getting done. He doesn't believe it. Fundamental reason why the price level has risen so rapidly since 1964 is that first column there called money supply. We have in this country an institution called the Federal Reserve System, which is technically owned by the commercial banks that are national banks, but that doesn't mean much. The Federal Reserve System is really controlled by and operated according to the lights of the federal government, or certain people in the federal government. The group that controls the Federal Reserve System is the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Seven men who sit in Washington, D.C. They are appointed by the president, approved by the Senate, and they make the decisions that the Federal Reserve System then implements. One of the most important powers of the Federal Reserve System is a practically unlimited ability to increase or decrease the money stock of the country. How much money is available at any moment of time? This can be determined, of course, within limits, because it's, they can always move it, they can't always hit just a target or after. They can go up or down, anytime they want. That's determined by the Federal Reserve. Since 1964, they have been increasing the money supply very rapidly. You'll notice, particularly from 1966 to 1967, they increased the money supply by about $11 billion. That just means, you know, that there's the same amount of goods floating around, but there are $11 billion more dollars to chase them. That's going to cause inflation. Now, actually, there weren't the same number of goods going around because output rose, too. Over in that fourth column, it says Industrial Production Index. That's the Federal Reserve Index of Industrial Production. And it's a sort of a measure of how output has been increasing or decreasing. And you'll notice that from 19, in those same years, output was increasing too. But notice that from 66 to 67, output didn't increase to anything like the rate at which the money supply increased. And some of that output was military output. And military output doesn't do, when dollars start chasing goods, they don't go chasing after military hardware. So that's military output is output that doesn't do much to check inflation.
Paul, when you say the money supply is increasing, you mean the Federal Reserve System has been just printing more pieces of paper with the dollar signs on them. Is that what you mean?
Not really. That's not really what they do. What they do, here we go into the technicalities. The Fed does, of course, print almost all of the green stuff that you have in your wallet. The Fed prints that. Okay. Or hasn't done the, it distributes it, hasn't done the Bureau of Trade. However, it prints more or less of that in response to consumer demand. In other words, if you go into the bank and you say, I need some cash for my trip, and so you draw down your checking account, $200, and get $10, $20 bills, And if a lot of people are doing that during vacation time, as in fact they do, the Fed simply prints more money. But then, after your vacation, you see, you go on your vacation and you spend all those $20 bills in motels and gas stations around the country, and these guys deposit it in their banks, and the banks find themselves with more currency at the end of the summer than they want. So they send it back to the Federal Reserve and the Fed burns it. Yeah. Now what you are really doing, you see, when the Fed prints money, it is really substituting one kind of money for another. Maybe I better stress this. If it puzzles you, forget it. But if it helps you, hang on to it. So there are many ways of defining the stock of money. The definition that most people use, the one that I've used here, is the total amount of currency outside the banks. See, if it's inside the banks, it's not money, because you can't use it for transactions. Plus the total of all of our checking accounts. And our checking accounts are the biggest part of the money supply. Now, why pick on these two things? See, what we're interested in is what people can use to buy goodies. If we want to know how many monies there is chasing after those goods. If there's too many monies chasing too few goods, we're going to have inflation. Right now, what kind of things are capable of chasing goods? Money in your back pocket, your currency, plus checking accounts. Why not savings accounts? You can't spend a savings account. To spend a savings account, you have to first convert it into a checking account or into currency.
Can I look at a checking account as the federal government prints currency and we print money by writing out checks?
No. How does the Fed increase or decrease the money supply? Basically, by making available to commercial banks more reserves. And when the Federal Reserve puts more reserves in the accounts of commercial banks, those banks are capable of making more loans. And when banks make loans, they create checking accounts. That's it in a nutshell. So you go into the bank to borrow $500. The bank looks at its reserves, has the figures there, and it says, do we have enough reserves to make this loan? Because they've got to preserve a certain ratio between their liabilities outstanding and that reserve account in the Federal Reserve Bank. And if it's got to be 5-1. In other words, for every dollar of reserve, they're allowed to have $5 of liabilities outstanding. Okay? Now, when they loan you money, they're creating, first of all, their own liability. Because what they do is give you a checking account. If you go into a commercial bank and ask to borrow $500, they'll say, well, do you have a checking account here? Well, for one reason, they say, if you don't bank with us, why do you borrow? But anyway, you could borrow when money is not tight. You can borrow from a bank or a checking account. They will ask you if you want them to create a checking account for you. They'll create one of them, put that money in there. The bank has actually created money. And when you retire the loan, you see, you come in, you either let your checking account build up to $500 and then write a check, which then destroys your checking account, and the money supply drops $500. Or you save cash, currency, outside the bank in the cookie jar, and you come in with that, and you put it in the bank. That destroys $500 worth of money. But now the key to the thing is that the Federal Reserve System, by increasing or decreasing those reserves that the commercial banks own, expands or contracts the bank's ability to make loans and hence their ability to increase or decrease the money.
And also the bank makes money by making loans. So
yeah, but that's unimportant. Okay. To the bank it's very important that for our purposes.
Okay.
Where does the interest rate come into
the
picture now?
Well, you mean everybody's concerned about rising interest rates, right?
Yeah,
don't
they raise the interest rate to check inflation?
Yeah, let me come to that. In fact, I goofed. I meant to put the prime rates on this chart, and I forgot to put prime rates on it. But I'll talk about the whole business of why the interest rate's been going up, and what does it mean, and is that supposed to check inflation? But that's a different question now. The use of interest rates as a kind of regulator of the economy is a different thing from what he mentioned, the bank also makes money by charging interest.
And the government would regulate the amount of money the bank is making by giving the bank money so that the bank can make loans. And if the government doesn't give the bank money to make loans, then the bank can't make as much money.
Yeah, that's, that sounds plausible, and I'll let it go. It's not really true.
Okay.
because there are other complications. See, the trouble is, when the Federal Reserve makes more reserves available to banks, that not only gives banks more money to loan, that knows it, we make more loans, it also increases the competition among the banks for potential borrowers. So you got a double effect where they may be able to make more loans, but only at lower interest rates. And will their earnings go up or go down? Bankers have the conviction, seemingly, I think bankers and the general public have the conviction that banks make more money when interest rates are high. Well, when interest rates are high, usually, the Federal Reserve is contracting the money supply, and it's contracting the bank's power to make loans. So it leads to an anomaly that what each bank wants is for it to have lots of reserves so it can make loans like crazy, and for every other bank to have its back to the wall. It's just like like a Minnesota wheat farmer. What he wishes for is a bumper crop for him and bugs in everybody else's field.
Okay.
Maury? The question arises, why has the Fed done this? If the Fed has all the power, I said, why has it gone ahead and created all these reserves and let the banks make loans and hence increase the money supply and thus cause inflation? The principal way that the Fed expands its member banks' reserves is through purchasing government securities. I won't, if you want to talk later about why, it's really quite simple, but I don't want to bore you with that. The point is that the Fed, when it buys a government bond, I'll just explain it. The government needs money. Help, we need $100,000. Fed says, sells the bond. So the Treasury now sells the Fed a bond. The Fed writes the Treasury a check for $100,000, and the Treasury goes out and spends it in the aircraft factories of Los Angeles. Well, that $100,000 is used for payrolls. And the guys on Friday, $100,000 extra is deposited in all kinds of checking accounts in the Los Angeles area. And those checks get cleared back through the Federal Reserve. And every bank, the banks collectively find themselves now with $100,000 more reserves in their accounts. That's the process, anyway, if you didn't understand it, don't worry about it. By which the Fed basically increases the reserves of member banks. By selling government bonds, it reverses this process. But notice that this little thing shows the quantity of United States securities held by the Federal Reserve System. And after 1960, I put down each successive year. Notice how that's been expanded in recent years, just since 1964. Let's start expanding 63, 64. But in a period of inflation, the Fed has actually been expanding bank credit by $4 to $5 billion a year. And for every dollar of bank reserves that it creates, the commercial banks have the power to create $3 or $4 new dollars of loans. So that's really to do for the Fed to buy Treasury securities in the last few years has been a terribly inflationary thing to do, but it's been doing it. And here's the record that it's been doing it. Well, why has it been doing it? Fundamental explanation comes in that next column. If the Fed doesn't buy the government securities, who will? And the government's got to sell the securities. Now, why does the government have to sell the securities? For the same reason that if you want to live beyond your means, you have to sell securities. If you want to spend more money, say you want to get a new car and you don't have the money, you want to live beyond your means, you sell a security. You create a bond. Says payable in 3 years with such and such interest rate, and you sell it to the bank, or you sell it to Household Finance Corporation. and the government has been spending, living way beyond its means because it is fighting a war and it is not willing to tax us heavily enough to pay for that war. Why isn't it willing to tax us heavily enough? Well, now we get into political questions for sure. But look at the size of the deficits that the government has been running in this decade, starting with 1961. Got something out of line. Well, that figure for $13 billion back here, that should be 1958, it looks like it's 59. I got jimmied up there somehow. Anyway, we ran a huge deficit. Eisenhower did that. I would like to point that out. The largest peacetime deficit in history, Eisenhower ran up. That was a recession year, and I think it was a wise deficit. I'll pull it out of the second. But now I'm interested in the decade of the 60s. Look at that. Every year since 1961, we've run a deficit. Well, 61, 62 maybe made sense because we were in a recession. Look how high, and I'll go way over to that column unemployment here. Look how high the unemployment level was in 61. 6.7% of the labor force was unemployed. 6.8% had been back in 58, another recession. The idea there was to, the deficit, was for the government sort of by spending to take up some of the slack in the private sector of the economy, get people back to work, get the economy humming again. But after we recovered, and the Index of Industrial Production, that IPI thing up there, sort of shows the recovery after 61. Notice the nice spurt that it took. However, unemployment didn't go down. That bothered a lot of people. And so, though the economy now started to boom in 1962, unemployment didn't really drop. It seemed to be very sticky up there at 5.5%. And so we kept on, partly as a matter of policy, running deficits. Sure, there were people who said we ought to balance the budget, but they weren't strong enough. There, you know, basically, none of us wants taxes increased, and none of us wants spending cut in his home district. Now, when you add to this a theoretical argument of some plausibility that to increase taxes or cut spending might cause more unemployment in a time when unemployment is already 5.5% of the labor force, well, it's not likely to balance the budget, and we didn't. But in order to make it possible for the government to run an unbalanced budget, the Fed has to cooperate. The Fed has to keep increasing bank credit so that the government can sell its security. And that's what happened. And of course, then in 67, 68, when we really started pouring money into Vietnam, the government ran an extremely juicy deficit. Those, actually, those budget figures are for the government fiscal year. So 68 really is the middle of 67 and the middle of 68, but that's not that important. Well, I want to just call your attention to a little couple of equations over there, MV equals PP. That is three marks, meaning it's an identity. It's got to be true. It's defined to be true. M stands for the money supply. V, velocity, stands for the average number of times each unit of money changes hands in a given time period, say a year. The way you figure this out empirically is say you have a rule. Every time somebody spends a unit of money, any kind of money, he puts a punch in it. He puts in one punch if it's a dollar that he's spending. He puts in 10 punches if it's $10 that he's spending. He puts in a quarter of a punch if he's spending 2 bits and so on. It'd be very, very difficult to do. But at the end of the year, you count up all the punches, and you divide that by the total money stock, and you have the velocity of circulation. Well, actually, we don't get it that way. The way we get the velocity of circulation is by multiplying the price level, whatever index we're using, times whatever measure we're using of T, the total number of transactions that take place in a given period. That maybe we may just use gross national product for that. And then dividing it by M. So actually, we divide P times T by M, and the residual is V. And that's why MV has got to equal PT. All right, now, what's the use of this? The use of this equation is indicated, one use of it is indicated in the next little equation, which has only two bars, because that ain't necessarily so. It says, let's assume that V is pretty constant. The average number of times each unit of money changes hands doesn't alter too much. That's a function of human nature or whatever. Anyway, if it changes slowly. That would mean that if that's true, then using our identity, which we know is true, the price level, P, is going to be equal to the money supply, the stock of money that the Fed can change, divided by the total number of transactions taking place, which is a function of the output of the economy. Well, that suggests that if the price level is going up, the Federal Reserve System is at fault because it's increasing the money supply. Well, that all sounds very simple. I just told you. It's a stupid Federal Reserve. You knew it all along. If it ain't unions, it's the government. But that little equation points something else out, too. What happens if the government pushes down the money supply? Will the price level necessarily fall according to this little equation? What else could happen? And that still hold true?
Number of transactions.
Transactions would go down. Right? Transactions would go down. In other words, we could have a recession. And that seems to be one of the real dilemmas of monetary policy. Every economist, I think, will admit that the Fed, by practicing monetary restraint, of course, it's very difficult to practice monetary restraint when the government's running deficits like this and the Treasury's pleading with you not to. And here's one half of the government arguing with the other half that while the Fed is an autonomous board, in a sense, Congress can quickly make it unautonomous if it gets too autonomous. You know, it's like the freedom your wife gives you. You're free as long as you don't exercise. Even if the Fed were free from Treasury pleading, the danger is that while it could prevent inflation if it wanted to, it might find that in order to push the price level down or hold it steady, it had to depress P a great deal. We might find that the only way to stop inflation is to cause recession. Now, why should that be? Well, that gets us into some of the things that I want to talk about on Wednesday when we talk about Keynesian economics. But most basically, to the extent to which our price system is rigid, to the extent to which our economy is not flexible, especially in a downward direction, a tight money policy will cause more recession than it will stop inflation. If prices, were all set by competitive forces of supply and demand, so that a little increase in demand caused them to boom up, a little decrease in demand caused them to shoot down, it would be relatively easy for the Federal Reserve to give us price stability without any serious cost in terms of recession and unemployment. But prices don't behave that way. There are a lot of rigidities in the economy. And so when the Fed pushes down on the money supply, it tends to push up on the unemployment rate. And which is a greater evil? Somebody in the Fed is asking himself this question. What's the acceptable trade-off ratio between unemployment and inflation? And how much unemployment are we willing to put up with to avoid how much inflation? Some people talk as if inflation is the greatest evil in the world. I think there are people whose jobs are rarely threatened by recession. Other people talk as if getting the unemployment level down to 2% should be the great goal of policy. And I think these people are just foolish. They haven't thought at all about the interrelationships among policy goals. I doubt we could in this country get the unemployment level down to 2% per year without something like a 10-15% rate of inflation per year. And that would probably disrupt the economy so badly that the unemployment would not stay at 2%, but would shoot up maybe something like we enjoyed in the 1930s, 25% of the labor force unemployment.
Well, that equation there doesn't relate unemployment at all.
No, no. Except that unemployment, you can say, is a function of T. The higher T, the lower the level of unemployment, sort of.
Well, can we say that P is indicative of rising or decreasing inflation? Is P?
Yeah.
Well, if the money supply decreases and the transactions decrease, then the price level could stay the same.
Say again, if the
money supply goes down, which causes probably cause transactions to go down, the price level could stay the same.
Right, that's the problem. That's the problem. You see, some people are, my point here is that people are frequently nagging the Fed, say, hey, you guys can move the money supply up or down and you can make the price level behave. Trouble is, the Fed can't do it without affecting T. T moves too. And we don't always want T.
You made the statement earlier that military goods, the production of military goods, does not have much of an effect on stemming inflation. Doesn't it really have the opposite effect, that when you're spending a substantial portion of your money for the creation of military goods, doesn't it tend to create inflation in the sense that you're putting a lot of money out in payroll and not producing corresponding goods for that money for the people to consume?
Well, no one's interested in looking at that anymore. Not necessarily. You see, suppose the government bought all of its military hardware out of current taxes and ran no deficit, then true, it would pay people $1 million to produce airplanes. It would send those airplanes over to Southeast Asia and blow them up. Now, those people have got $1 million, but they can't buy their own product. You know. So you think that's going to cause inflation. The trouble is now the government steps in and collects $1 million in taxes and takes it right away from them.
So then there's less money to spend. What I'm saying is that if they don't do that on taxes, you keep a larger supply of money in circulation, but you don't have a corresponding production of consumer goods. Whereas if you did finance the war by current taxes, then you wouldn't have as large a supply of money competing for the consumer goods that are available.
Well, I'm not sure. Let me try putting it the way I see it and see if that jives or not what you're saying. Government spending on war has two effects, one a short run, one a longer run. In the short run, government spending on war is inflationary only if the government runs a deficit. If the government finances that spending by current taxes, it's not inflationary. However, in the long run, it will be inflationary to spend money on war, even if you do balance the budget every year, because goods produced for the private economy have a tendency, some of them at least, to be goods producing goods. So that, you know, when we're just producing consumer goods, some of the things we're producing are drill presses and capital goods, things that will produce more goods, fertile, prolific goods. But military goods are never this kind. Military goods are consumer goods, strictly. Goods for immediate consumption. That's the long-run inflationary consequence of military spending. And in every wartime period in our history, we've seen this. We've seen that, we're seeing it now in an indirect way, that the quality of our capital stock deteriorates. The way we're seeing it right now is that business is spending fantastic sums on capital improvement, and that's we're feeding the inflationary fire, trying to prevent that deterioration of capital stock.
With the exception of times when we've had a government control of wage and price, isn't it uniformly or historically true that you have inflation during time of war?
Well, that isn't even an exception. Yeah.
It's restrained somewhat when the government does that.
Yeah. Our big inflations have always been wartime.
Keep this, the government keeps running that much in debt every year, it's going to end someplace, don't it? I mean, doesn't it make a little bit more sense to have just a little bit more taxes and kind of come out at least halfway here, quote?
Well,
I mean, it's fine to not pay taxes, but 40 years from now, I still have to have a country here, so I might be willing to pay another 10 cents to, you know.
Well, you're worried that the public debt is getting too large.
Yeah.
Well, in 1946, right after World War II, the U.S. debt was larger than our total annual output of goods and services. In other words, it's kind of the nation was in hock for more than its annual income. About right. Today, the debt is bigger, isn't it? Yeah, and it's about 40% of our annual income. Now, who owes more money? A little boy with an allowance of 50 cents a week who owes a quarter? Or a little boy with an allowance of $5 a week who owes 50 cents? The public debt, the absolute size of the public debt, you know, this horrifying figure, $342 billion, you know, which staggers you, which used to worry me when I was a kid. I was selling war stamps during World War II and war bonds, and I thought of all these things. You're going to see the public debt go up and up and up and up, and I realized I was contributing to the public debt every time I sold a war stamp, and I had a little medal put on my Sunday school suit. And I figured out that 10 years from now, when I would be only 22 years old, I was going to have to pay back $1,600, you know. And I laid awake nights. I just saw the government on my 22nd birthday going on, all right, hey, cough up your 1600. Well, let me tell you that your fears today about the absolute size of public debt are as groundless as my fears were then. The United States government could today, I'm convinced, and most economists would agree, with relative ease, handle a public debt 3 times the size of the current debt. I'm not recommending, because what is really bad is increasing the debt. It is the act of increasing it that is bad, because the increasing of the debt is the running of a deficit, and this is inflationary. But if we were to slide off into a recession, I would call for increases in the public debt. Meaning, I'd call directly for deficit spending to check the inflation. When Eisenhower was so proud of all those budget surpluses he ran, you know, back here, Eisenhower came in 52, you know, and he had a little one presented to him by Truman for starting off. But then Truman also presented him with a lot of appropriations commitments. So 53, his first fiscal year, just half of his year, he ran a 5.3 deficit. But then he tried to whittle that deficit down. By golly, 56 and 57 fiscal year, we ran a surplus. You remember? And we were proud of the, and yeah, so we had a recession in 58. And which caused, something is wrong there. Those figures should all be kicked up. I don't know what's happened. Oh, no. Excuse me. They're right. That's the fiscal year. It was the 59 fiscal year, which ran through the guts of the 58 recession. Okay, that's right. But notice, in that recession, which came in the last quarter of 57, the first 2 quarters of 58, Eisenhower's administration coughed out $16 billion in order to check a recession that his $7.3 million surplus had cost. That his surplus hadn't just cost. But we have to be very, very careful. This is about what, and I'm not exaggerating now. We have to be very, very careful of budget surpluses as well as budget deficits. Budget surpluses are dangerous too. So I am opposed to any rapid increase in the public debt, and I am opposed to any rapid decrease in the public debt. Occasionally you run across people who have these schemes for retiring the public debt, because they're worried about bequeathing this to their grandchildren. Don't let that bug you. You're not only bequeathing a $340 billion debt to your grandchildren, you're also bequeathing $340 billion of assets to your grandchildren. Somebody owes it, but somebody owns it, too. Somebody out there has got money in the bank, got those assets. So don't fret that. Don't buy any scheme for retiring the public debt the next year or the next 10 years even. it would almost certainly cause the worst recession we've seen. You just can't do that.
Suppose a peace occurred in Vietnam tomorrow, and what would be the effects on the U.S. economy?
A tremendous dislocation, and probably a big recession. Unemployment rate would skyrocket, being caused, all of the people who, not all, excuse me, a large percentage of the people working in government-related industries would quickly be retired, or forced to go to the sidelines until some kind of reconversion is taking place. So if there is a rapid end to hostilities, and the government is satisfied with its stockpile of military hardware that's depleted now, you know, so that if the war were to end tomorrow, we still produce military goods for a while to build up a stockpile once more. But that is going to postpone the day of reckoning. Eventually there will be a day of reckoning when the Korean War, let us pray, does come to an end. And that's going to be an extraordinary
Vietnam War. You said Korean. Ending the war in Vietnam is a good check on inflation, huh?
Sure. Yeah, but the Vietnam War is the basic cause of the inflation we're losing.
But it, in your opinion, would cause unemployment and a severe recession if it were done rapidly, huh?
Well, yeah, but there are ways of making the recession short and of aiding, speeding, facilitating that the transition and the recovery. And there's a good deal of research that has been done on this. And we would have to expect dislocations. But dislocations are a part of a capitalistic economy. That's one of the disadvantages that you accept along with the advantages of capitalism. Capitalism's advantages are its flexibility, its ability to cause and respond to change. One of its disadvantages is the dislocations that it causes for people. You know, that's the trouble with any flexible, free, spontaneous person. He upsets other people. That's the trouble with Carol. You know? You can't predict it. You never know what he's going to do. That's what makes him great.
I wonder if the economy could absorb, though. Some people have been spent 20 years of their life in a defense-type industry making missiles and making bombs and talking about kill probabilities and these kinds of things. So some of these people are pretty highly specialized, and I wonder how adaptable they'd be to the mundane things of making washing machines or something like that.
I should think more. Very much. You don't have to be satisfied
with washing machines. You can worry about conquering pollution and all kinds of exciting possibilities, that all this talent and energy can be diverted to.
Yeah, Mark Rudd of the SDS, one of our campus revolutionaries, argues that one of the reasons why college students are becoming alienated from the capitalist system is because the careers that they see before them are these meaningless careers of producing missiles. And that if they could find really worthwhile things to do, they could be excited. And of course, he argues in the video that socialism and an end of the capitalist system, they'll never find anything to produce but missiles. But I'm impressed at least with the first half of that argument.
There's a basic economic factor, though. I think the missile makers or the defense industry pays the highest wages by far than private enterprise. And a missile trajectory engineer who gets $20,000 a year would find that in the real world of washing machines, let's say, he might get $12,000.
Yeah.
And he's based his standard of living on $20,000.
Well, don't you think, though, that the United States will always be more or less at war if it quits in Vietnam like it did in Korea? We're going to go to the Mediterranean area, or we're going to if the moon isn't the limit, we're going to go to Mars or someone else. And we'll always have a military budget, and these guys will just keep producing. We might even be sending arms to India after a while, or some other things.
Yeah, well.
Well,
At least it can be cut somewhat.
It could be cut, but I think maybe not at the rate that we're spending today.
You're saying we should always have the war to prevent a recession?
Well, that's...
You're saying we'll probably always have a military budget in the future.
Right, yeah. I mean, Russia's always creating a hotspot for us.
Yeah.
Maybe, I hope they don't take that. It's a bad way to look, yeah. But we're always being kept on our toes, moving from one side of the world to the other.
Yeah, to bounce off what you're saying, that's kind of an interesting phenomenon that college graduates just aren't interested in those jobs. And it's been a part of industry. Kind of an increasing concern that they can't get engineers. There just aren't kids out of college that want those kinds of jobs.
Well, I think it's a characteristic of youth. They're idealistic, and they want to do meaningful things with their life.
Really?
But as they get older, in their 40s, and their families are growing, they find that they do need money to live on. And some of the more meaningful jobs to society, I think, pay the least.
Yes.
Listen, I don't know who's that for you. Anyway, on Wednesday, I'll pick up the question of interest rates and what happens after inflation, and thinking of John Maynard Keynes, what we know and don't know, and what we think we know, but really don't know.